tell us about efficient generation of generic
things? Thank you.
Thanks, Sean, Isabeau, and Eden for organizing this. I think it's a really nice idea. The only thing is, I think maybe Robin was right that you should have called it brilliant minds instead of budding minds. But maybe it's more accurate with the budding minds anyway. I'm going to talk about efficient generation of generic entanglement. I'm not going to presume that you know what any of those words mean at the moment. This is joint work with Martin Peña, who's my supervisor at Imperial, and Roberto Oliveira, who's at the time was a postdoc at IBM Yorktown, and now he's an associate professor in Brazil in the National Institute for Pure and Applied Mathematics. So efficient generation of generic entanglement. Just so you don't get confused already with the first title, I'm going to just briefly explain what the words mean. So entanglement, you've probably heard about it. It's a key feature of quantum information theory, and also in foundations of quantum mechanics. And I think we'll find that it's related to these black hole entropy things. So when I say entanglement here, I'm going to mean, unless I state otherwise, the simplest form of entanglement, which is that you have two parties, Alice and Bob. So some system here, which is Alice, and some system here, which is Bob. And they're in some global state, which is pure. And there's bipartite entanglement between them, which means it's the simplest form. And it just means you quantify it as the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix of Alice, or Bob equivalently. So that's the So this is the entanglement between Alice and Bob. Sorry? Yeah, this is log. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Right, okay. So rho A is the trace over Bob of rho AB. So maybe I should give an example. The simplest example is I think this is the simplest one you can think of, which would be that you have this is your global state. And there's a normalization factor in there. So actually, when I write 0, 0, I mean the tensor product. So these, the first one belongs to Alice, the second one to Bob. Now, if I want to take the reduced density matrix, rho A, I would take, because you know how normally if you want to take the trace, you take the bra and the ket on each side of the matrix. So this is the same thing, but you only do it with respect to Bob's degrees of freedom. So you would take this as Now, I think you'll get a little bit messy if I write rho AB out. You get a few terms. But what you find is where you just have to trust me that what you get is the maximally mixed state. Sorry, Alice. So the point is that they're maximally entangled, and the way that we quantify that is by looking at the entropy of the reduced subsystem. So that's the S of rho A. And if you have the maximally mixed state, that's the most mixed state you can get. So that's maximal entanglement in this case. So this is a maximally entangled state. Okay, so that's the sort of entanglement I'm going to talk about when I say entanglement. So by generic entanglement, I would really guess you haven't heard about that. That's a term that was introduced in this paper by Patrick Hyde and Debbie Leung and Andreas Winter. I prefer maybe to call it typical entanglement because that's what it means. It's the sort of thing you have... is there anything underneath here? Okay. So I have the entanglement on this axis for some given system. Sorry. Yep. And the probability of the entanglement on this axis. Then if the probability distribution looks like this, then I could say, oh, this is the typical value. They realized this, and I asked Patrick, why didn't you call it typical to start with? And he said it's because typical is used in other settings in information theory. And they didn't want to confuse the two, so therefore they call it generic entanglement. Which I guess is not exactly the same as typical, but I think of it as typical entanglement. Okay, so I should also explain this. We mean the entanglement average over pure states picked from the uniform Haar distribution. So I'll go into this a little bit more, but you can take you can pick pure states at random. So you could take a probability distribution on your pure states. And there's a particular distribution, which is the sort of maximum entropy distribution on these, which is the uniform distribution. I think I'll define it later more carefully. So that's the link to this, is that you would be picking your states. You'd be picking psi AB from that distribution. And then you have an associated entanglement probability distribution. When I say generating, I'm going to mean that you have a random process that actually yields this typical entanglement as a result. Efficiently, this is used a lot in quantum information theory. And it just means polynomially in the size of the problem. So we're going to have our systems are going to be qubits, two-level quantum systems. Sort of the simplest non-trivial quantum system. And we're going to have n of these. And if the number of steps necessary to generate, so you have interactions between these, then if the number of interactions goes as a polynomial in n, as opposed to an exponential in n, then you say that it's efficient. And of course, that's from sort of computer science, because if you want to solve a problem, it's a good thing if it doesn't require so many time steps. So you would regard, in computer science, you'd regard an exponential scaling as a problem. It means the problem is more difficult to solve. OK. Any questions on this slide? OK. So the structure of the talk, the aim is to explain the key points of these two papers, which relate to efficient generation of generic entanglement. First, I give an introduction. Then there'll be two key results. The first one is that generic entanglement is generated efficiently. And that's an analytical result. The second one is a numerical observation, which is that generic entanglement is achieved at a particular instant. And then I give a conclusion. So why did we start looking at this? Well, this is sort of the true story. Actually, it's not entirely the true story why, but this is the more proper motivation. So there's something called entanglement theory, which tries to quantify entanglement. So this is a sort of maybe a very basic aspect of entanglement theory. You can put a number to someone gives you a quantum state that says how much entanglement is there here. You can give a number to that. And it gets a lot more complicated than that. You can ask all sorts of questions, like what can I do with the entanglement if I want to achieve some sort of processing task. So there's this whole field called entanglement, subfield rather, called entanglement theory. However, we have problems in extending entanglement theory to multipartite entanglement. And I'm actually not going to deal with that here, but this is the motivation. Here we're talking about bipartite entanglement. Normally, you say you do a cut. You say, oh, this is Alice, this is Bob. What's the entanglement across this cut? But you could have all sorts of complicated cuts, and then you get multipartite entanglement. And this is actually something that hasn't really been solved in entanglement theory. And the reason is it gets so complicated. There's so many different types of entanglement. You get a sort of exponentially rising number of types of entanglement if you consider multipartite ones.
Yeah, but any of us have simple thought experiments or an example of how we can visualize the type of entanglement we're trying to create right now. So is there an example of how to generic entanglement? It doesn't even have to be an exact example, just if you can walk us through some way of preparing the system so you can see how this kind of entanglement differs from.
Okay, so I think, in a way, the whole talk is aimed at telling you this. So how do you generate generic entanglement? So if you allow me, I'll sort of go on, and hopefully I'll answer that. Okay, so the idea is then, can we sort of avoid this problem of the exponentially growing number of types of entanglement by only considering typical types of entanglement? So if this sort of thing happens in general, then maybe you could say that a lot of these types of entanglement are actually very exotic and unlikely. So similarly to in thermodynamics, we can sort of ignore those and make a theory for the typical entanglement. So like I said before, typical has been defined relative to a flat distribution of pure states. And this is a key thing here. So how do you define a flat distribution of pure states? Well, one thing you can do is you can sort of imagine you have all these pure states. Then you assign a probability to each pure state. And the flat distribution is the one which remains invariant if you mess these states around. So it's the one that's invariant if you apply unitaries. So the probability of a state is the same as the probability after you apply the unitary to the state. However, one can question whether this is a physically valid thing to do, to just pick pure states from this distribution. In nature, in general, we're going to have a lot of restrictions on what pure states we can have. And some people have actually done these things for, like, talked about the universe, and let's say we pick a state of the universe from this distribution. One possible problem is the one we're going to deal with here, which is that you need an exponential number in the system size of 2-qubit gates. So 2-qubit gate would be you have two of these and you apply a unitary interaction on the two. An exponential number of such gates are required to generate an arbitrary pure state. And in general, things in nature are local, so interactions are local. So you have the sort of generalization of this notion of two qubit gates. And then you might suspect that actually if I restrict myself to local interactions, I'm going to get something quite different from this unbiased distribution of pure states. So we felt, oh, this seems unphysical to talk about this distribution. And actually, to be honest, we set out to prove that it was unphysical. And we were thinking, how can we, what will we find in a polynomial number of steps? Will that be something qualitatively different? But now I've twisted the aim around to the opposite of what it originally was. So I'm going to say the aim is to prove that in spite of this problem, the average entanglement associated with the unitarily invariant measure is physical, in that it appears after a polynomial number of gates. So we're picking states from this distribution when we define typical entanglement. And we're saying that that assumption is not valid because we're suspecting at this stage, we're going to find it's not true, but we're suspecting at this stage that this assumption will give you a very different typical entanglement to picking states that are generated from a polynomial number of local interactions. Yeah, they are. I mean, so the reason, what I alluded to is that this is how we first thought. We first thought we'll prove that this typical or generic entanglement thing is not really physically relevant. And there's something else instead, which is what happens in a polynomial time of local interactions.
Yeah.
But then
the aim really was to prove that that's the case,
that it's not physical. But I'm twisting it around here because we found the opposite conclusion.
No. You say so, and however, you say that an exponential number of gates are necessary to have a flat distribution. In your aim, you say that you can get a flat distribution with a polynomial number of gates. So that seems
no, good. I'm not saying that you can get a flat distribution. So yeah, this is an important distinction. I'm saying that you can get the same entanglement probability distribution. So this is the entanglement probability distribution associated with picking states from the flat distribution of pure states. But I'm saying if you pick states from, so we'll find, if you pick states from a polynomial restriction on this state space, you get the same entanglement probability distribution.
Oh, I see.
But not the same state space distribution.
So then why is that making this question? I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah. I try to give you some intuition of where that's possible. Okay, so as I said, we had a random process that generates this typical entanglement. So this is, to make it concrete, we chose a very particular model, which is very natural for a quantum information person to choose, but you might find it odd. So we're going to consider random two-party interactions modeled as two-qubit gates. So I don't know if you've seen these sort of diagrams, but I'm going to assume you haven't. So each line represents a qubit. And you have some input state here, of some global input state. And you're going to apply unitaries in between. And then you have some global output state afterwards. So, for example, if I just want to apply a unitary of this qubit, I would do like this.
That box represents a gate, which is just a unitary interaction. I could do similarly, I could apply a single one on this one. And then I could also do unitaries that mix the interact with different qubits. So, for example, I could do something called a C0. Okay, so now that is going to be a different output state here. This thing you probably haven't seen. C0 means controlled not gate. So you have two qubits. It controls the first one, which is written in this way, that's this bit. If it's one, then it flips in the second bit. But if it's not one, it does nothing. So this is what it does. Yeah, and if you toy with that, you can see that as a unitary interaction. And it's a very important gate in quantum information theory, because we use it as an elementary gate. So you would
build up your more complicated circuits from things like that.
Yes, they demonstrated
for two qubits, that sort of thing. They can demonstrate these things up to some accuracy.
This is probably an obvious question, but the C0 gate, it's not dependent on the basis there, right? So suppose you wrote this along the z-axis and the z-axis basis, and you were to switch it to the x-axis basis, it would be written exactly the same way.
Yes. But normally we work in the computational basis. Right. So it would be... That's how the matrix that we represented in a computational basis. And if you change your basis, you'd have to apply the basis changing units right here.
Actually, if you change basis to the z basis, what will happen is it'll actually reverse the control and the target will actually flip.
Oh, okay.
So it does actually look different.
Oh,
for sure. That matrix will be different.
Yeah, so it's going to be a different matrix.
Yeah, that's what I want to know. If you choose an orthogonal basis, does it look different than different basis?
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure if I'm sorry, but it's different than that. Yeah, so it's the same as normal unitary. Like, if you change your basis, you have to apply the same basic changing unitary to your gate. Okay, so the random process then. You pick U and V, which are single qubit unitaries, uniformly from the block sphere. That might be a new word, but that's. Actually, if I introduce every term so carefully, I'm not going to get through this. That's the flat distribution on one qubit. Then you choose a pair of qubits, C and D. Like these ones, for example. And so you pick any pair equally likely, and then you apply C0 to those two. So what you get is something like this. You have an input state, an output state at the end, and in between, in the first time step, I pick these two qubits, apply this thing. Second time step, maybe I pick these two. I pick these two using the qubit unitaries, and so on. So you get something like this, and you have to go on a bit further to get to the entanglement. So first, understanding what happens after infinite time. And this was known before our work. So after infinite time steps, the entanglement E, I call it, is expected to be nearly maximal, which is sort of a neat thing to know. So what it's saying is if you just pick gates at random and you keep applying asymptotically, your output state is going to be maximally entangled. And this may not surprise you if you think of this as a thermalization process. So, in more precisely, there's this result from a combination of these papers that in the infinite limit, so infinitely many gates, the expectation of the entanglement of the output state, so that's the state that comes out here, and you divide this into, say, these could belong to Alice and these could belong to Bob. So like here, so you have NA qubits belonging to Alice and B to Bob. The expectation is lower bounded by this.
Now, this is actually the maximal entanglement that you can have. Because it's basically the number of it's basically the number of pairs like this that they could share. So you could have if Alice, for example, only has two qubits, the maximum entanglement would, an example of a maximally entangled state would be, say, this one is shares a maximally entangled state like that with that qubit, and this one shares the maximally entangled state with that one. But you can't go beyond that. So the size of the smaller party limits the amount of entanglement that you can have. So this is the maximal. And then there's a small little thing here, which is not really very significant, and in some limits it's zero. So basically, I think you sort of need to know that actually you just, if you keep doing this, your state is going to be maximally entangled at the output.
N here is not the number of qubits Alice and Bob has, is it?
Which
2 to the minus n. I think you've got the wrong n's there, because that's just constant, the number of qubits they have. It should be the n, the number of steps that you're using.
No, so I'm taking the limit as the number of steps goes to infinity.
Yes, but you don't have them. Okay, but.
So this NA and ND,
yeah,
is this one, so it's the number.
But the other thing is not necessarily insignificant. It could be zero. It could be one. So if NA equals ND, right?
Right.
Then you have two to the minus zero, so you have one over log two, which is not necessarily that small.
Right. Okay. Oh, so you're asking, can I really ignore this term?
I'm just saying it's not necessarily small.
So I agree it's not necessarily obvious that this is the case, but if you look at the different possibilities, for example, if NA is much less than NB, then you agree that term is very small. Then you can have a case where NA is proportional to NB. So let's say NB, I'm going to say they're equal. That's the opposite of here. Then if you have this case, then that term is zero, like you say, the top term. So you have a term now which is like 1 over log 2. I feel like it should be a 2 here, but... the thing is, if you take n goes to infinity, whilst this is true...
No, but this is not the same thing. N, A, and N, D are the number of qubits, which is fixed.
And then, so... Okay, so actually what I should say, maybe with the confusion is that I'm actually, when I said that this is not important, I'm presuming that the total n is large. Okay, sorry, that's true.
But is capital N equal to n a plus n?
Yes. So that's why, if that's why n goes to infinity, then the minimum of n a and n b also goes to infinity. In this case, and therefore that second term becomes significant. So obviously, the reason I didn't spell that out is because I'm always thinking of this moving towards thermodynamics, but it's true that n is small, then this factor could be significant. So for example, if you have...
So you're taking two limits, because it wasn't clear enough, you're saying that you're taking two limits. So you're taking the limits in the number of parts, and the limits in the number of...
So that mathematical expression is true, even without n being large, but the wordy part when I said that this was insignificant, but then I was putting it in the part. So for example, if you have... if you pick the two qubit state at random, if you do this sort of thing, then you find that the output entanglement is something like, I think, 0.48. I might be wrong, but it's something around that. And whereas if it were maximal, it would be 1. But if you just take NA is equal to 1 and NB is like 100, then the average entanglement that the output is going to be around 1. Okay, so... Okay, that's the infinite number of steps. The question is, what happens in a polynomial number of steps? And then we have this theorem, analytical theorem, which is that the average entanglement of the unitary invariant measure is reached to a fixed arbitrary accuracy epsilon within an order of n cubed steps. So in pictures, that means if you have a sort of graph where, well, this is the average entanglement, this is the number of steps. We start off with our input state being unentangled, we start applying gates, and the average entanglement rises. We know that in the infinite step, the limit goes to the maximum, if n is large. And then if we fix some accuracy, epsilon to this, which can be arbitrarily small, and we ask, okay, how many more steps do I need to do if I increase the number of qubits in the system? Then you don't need to increase the number of steps more than an order of n cubed. So it's in a simpler way of putting it is that the circuit is expected, one of these circuits is expected to make the input state maximally entangled in a physical, so in a polynomial number of steps. Okay, so this is the more technical statement of this theorem. Let some arbitrary epsilon, but less than 1 be given. Then for number n of gates in the random circuit.
That satisfies this. So n is greater than or equal to, and this whole expression is the order of n cubed. We have that this is true. So you see, this is very similar to the asymptotic infinitely many steps limit. So the average is again here, and this is the maximal entanglement. This is that little term that you were asking me about. And here is now a factor representing that arbitrary accuracy that we can make as small as we like. That's quite possible, actually. Yeah. I think it should be a minus. Yeah, sorry, you're right. A corollary of this that you can derive from this is that that means that your output state is going to be very close to some maximally entangled state. So that's just saying that if these are the maximally entangled states, you maximize over all possible such states. You can find an inner product with the output state, which is lower bounded by this quantity. And again, this is that little term that you asked me about, and the arbitrary accuracy. Okay. So, okay, the proof is like 10 pages. So I'm just going to give you one slide. Which is a very simple intuition of why this might be true. So what you're doing when you apply a random circuit is that you start off with some input state. You're in the state space of quantum theory, which is really big. you apply your first gate, you take a little step in your state space. So maybe you start here, if this blue thing represents the state space. When you apply your first gate, you take a little step. You apply your second gate, you take a little step somewhere else. But these gates are picked at random. So what you're doing is a sort of random walk on the state space. But now the thing is that many of these states have the same entanglement. Because the entanglement state space goes between zero and this quantity that I gave you before. So the entanglement, which I also called S of rho A before, that's between these two quantities. So you see that range certainly does not grow exponentially in n. And that's basically the intuition why this is possible, is many states have the same entanglement, so you don't have to sample the whole state space to get the right average. Of course, it can be dangerous to have those sort of intuitions, but in this case, it seems to be true. So what we do is we say that there's an associated random walk on the smaller state space. So first I was thinking, okay, let's see if we can just do a random walk on the entanglement state space. The problem is that then it's no longer like a Markovian random walk, because the steps that you do are not independent of your position. And if you toy with that, you can see that's true. And then actually we found that you can do it in a more complicated way, where you use not the entanglement, but something related to the purity, which can tell you about the entanglement. The purity is
understand the word purity and entanglement to be polar opposites, in the sense that a state which is maximally entangled is opposite of a state which has maximal purity.
Something like this. I mean, they're not exact opposites. But certain limits, So some people try to, for example, take 1 over this as an entanglement measure sometimes.
Is there any other term aside from purity which would be the opposite measure of entanglement? Decoherence or something of that nature?
I'm not sure, apart from the sort of trivial thing, which would be like if we take entanglement and the 1 minus the entanglement or something like that.
Yes. And decoherence, would that figure in at all to these terms?
So what you mean with the cross, we said decoherence, you need a rate, and which the cross terms in the destiny.
Decoherence in the sense that it leads to purity.
So I'm not sure how to quantify. I know what you mean by decoherence, but I'm not sure how to quantify it and compare it to entanglement in that sense. I think you can view decoherence as being related to the buildup of entanglement with the environment. So maybe you can think of the buildup of entanglement as a measure of the amount of decoherence, but I doubt that's what's very hard to quantify.
Can I ask another question just about your state space?
Yeah.
Just for my own visualization of where we are, your state space, there's no problem describing it as a Hilbert space, tensor products. So you don't need to go into an extended Hilbert space. Extended Hilbert spaces were invented basically when Hilbert spaces weren't inadequate. So I don't want to introduce the term if it's unnecessary, especially if you're going to tell me that Hilbert spaces are adequate for your description. So are Hilbert spaces adequate to describe the state space?
But I might have to ask you after what you're referring to. So the second result is a numerical observation. And this is basically inspired by some results by people like Percy Diaconis, which refers to casinos and card shuffling. So if you're a casino owner, then you want to be able to randomize the cards as well as possible before you let people play with them, right? Shuffle, exactly. And the more technical term. So you and the question is like, how many shuffles do you need to do? Because maybe you'd like to do an infinite number of shuffles, but that's not very practical. So how many do you need to do before you search? And then they developed this theory around something called the cutoff effect, which is what we use here, which shows that, for example, if you do something called a riffle shuffle, I think it's 6 or 7 shuffles is enough. And the weird thing is that before these 6 or 7 shuffles, the gambler could quite feasibly try and take advantage of the fact that the deck is not shuffled, but after, the probability could be really low. So the question is, here we're sort of shuffling. And in one sense we're shuffling states, but this is a bit more subtle because we're going to look at the entanglement. And what you find is that there is a similar effect in that initially the entanglement cannot be expected to be typically maximal, and then there's a sort of time after which you can expect the entanglement to be typically maximal. So this is numerical now. So the total variation distance between the entanglement probability distribution
That you get at the infinite time limit and what you actually have. So this distance starts off being maximal, which is 1. In the infinite number of steps, it goes to 0.
Giving a riffle shuffle.
Yeah.
What happens to the entanglement as you proceed? So in the beginning, the deck is extremely coherent, and if you look at the cards, you'll find that they're bunched together. So you do your first shuffle, and you find they're still very bunched. And after 6 shuffles, you find the amount of cards which were previously adjacent is much, much less. So what does that mean in terms of entanglement? How does the entanglement change as you shuffle?
So I think one has to be, the analogy is not entirely literal, or it's a bit subtle how to transfer the analogy. I think it's best to think of it like, because the danger is that I give you the impression that you're shuffling, that we're looking at the state space shuffling, which is strictly speaking what we're doing. So strictly speaking, we are at the random walk shuffles the states, the random circuit. And which means the way you do is you're not directly affecting the entanglement as you do around the more state space, and you end up in a new state that's different entanglement.
And would that entanglement decrease with each successive shuffle?
No, so it would increase. So you would have, maybe I should go back to this picture. So
if you shuffled 1,000 times, your deck would be very randomized, but also very entangled.
So when you say the deck, you mean
we have a deck of cards, and you're going to shuffle a lot. And so I can say that the cards will be randomized. That part I understand.
Right. So there's an analogy of the cards now of the states, right?
Well, I would say each ordering of a card, each ordering of a deck would be a state in your state space. And so each shuffle takes you into a different point in your state space. But that's just my
idea. Okay, maybe you can think of it like that. So what was your question then?
So as you shuffle, the state of the deck becomes increasingly more random. Cards predict it. And then you mentioned that as you shuffle, the entanglement increases. And so when the state is completely unpredictable, right, it's been shuffled 1,000 times, you can't tell all the extra friends are in the back, you just don't know where they are. But you said that the entanglement is reaches approach the maximum.
Yes.
So it's, I just don't understand.
Yes, so this would be each sort of shuffle of the state space.
Yes.
And you start off with an unentangled state. Then, on average, you can go to the maximal entanglement state.
So,
Maybe if I can try to answer. I think the equivalent, so you have a bunch of states, right? And the equivalent of something that looks random in your car is something that's very, is a state that's really entangled.
Yes,
in
that's state. Exactly what I understood from that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so you start off with them being the probability distributions of entanglement being maximally separated, and at the infinite timing they become infinitely close. The key thing is whether this thing becomes more sharp. This is actually restating down here. So that you restate it so that they meet here. But the question is, does it become more sharp with the tend towards this as you increase the number of qubits? That's what happens in the card shuffling case. So if you had a lot of cards, like 100 instead of 52, you would have a sharper kind of effect. So this is blue is 6 qubits, green is 9. You see, slowly becoming more sharp. But you might feel, oh, this is so far still. It's not that impressive, right? And the reason is just that it's actually very difficult to simulate quantum systems on a computer because you need so many numbers specified because the state grows exponentially. So there's some tricks that you can do to go further. And there's a trick called stabilized states,
which Daniel Gottesman, who's here at PI, had lots to do with. And there's some tools from this paper that we used. I think I'm not going to explain stabilized states, but basically you have to take my word for it. You can use this trick, and then what you find is as you keep increasing it, it becomes more and more sharp. And I've done it for 200 now as well, and it's still a little bit sharper. So I think numerically you could say the trend is going towards a step function.
It could be a limiting slope, but if it is, it's not going to be that difficult. But because it's numerics, I'm not comfortable with that.
Well, it certainly looks like a phase transition, so there's definitely a difference of behavior from the small original axis.
The number of gates applied to your circuit?
Yeah. Perfect. So it looks like there's two regimes of completely different behavior, one where the TV is very large and one where it's zero.
Yeah.
Prospect has a step.
Okay, so in conclusion, there were two key points. The first one was that there's proof that generic entanglement is physical, as it can be generated using a polynomial number of two qubit gates. This has various implications, so there's some arguments and protocols that refer to generic entanglement, and they gain relevance. And I could also add that here's some work that was done on the basis of these results by Harrow in later work than this one, where he effectively, now to be honest, I haven't understood what he's done exactly, but he effectively shows that most quantum circuits outperform classical circuits at some task, and then he uses this proof from here. So the second result is that numerical observation that generic entanglement is achieved at a particular instant. Okay. And then, just as a question, which I think might relate to your talk, Aita, for example, which is I'm trying to understand how does this picture of typical entanglement relate to this area scaling idea. So this, say we've already heard about black holes today, about the area scaling of the entropy of black holes. Now, in this setting, what we have is more like a volume scaling. So this thing is the number of particles. So if you imagine some sort of lattice, and you divide it into say Alice and the rest of Bob, then it is known that for a lot of ground state Hamiltonians, the entanglement, so the entropy of this region, only depends on the number of connections across this boundary, and not on the total number of particles inside. So it doesn't matter how many particles are inside. So that's the area staying in the time loop. But actually here, everything is in time loop with everything. So what you have is that the entanglement scales as the number of particles in this region. So I think you can call that volume scaling of entanglement.
There are terms for this, right? So if something scales with area, it's the holographic principle. And if something scales with volume, it's just the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic variables. You just call it an extrinsic variable. It's understated what that means.
Okay. So does that, what does that mean in terms of?
It's only when scaling goes down to area that you can say, well, this is a holographic principle, right? All the information is stored in a three-dimensional hypersurface, and basically describe that holographic principle. But there's no need to do that when it's scaled with volume because it's just an intrinsic variable.
So yes, I guess what I'm, so there's a few questions that I have. Like one is, what is the entanglement of everyday objects? Because I would expect that it's somewhere between these two extremes, because this is like the infinite temperature thermalization regime. And the other one would probably be the zero temperature regime. And then the other question, which I'm really more curious about, is the black hole thing and why people view the area scaling as somehow fundamental.
As if the information was stored in a hologram. So,
yeah
that holographic principle can be applied in the case where you get to use it.
So you're not saying it's a universal principle?
No, you definitely need to have scalable area in order for the holographic principle to make sense.
Okay, that's
it. Well, actually, there are 2 layers of computing. Like, one is like why you know area CFT. One is why area CFT in terms of that the gravity is due to field around the boundary. And if you have then a kind of volume scale on the boundary of the entropy, so the boundary is just like an ordinary thermal system then. And so, and the other idea is that the thermodynamic system to consider is not space time, but it's the area of the horizon of the black hole. And so then if you have volume scaling with respect to the volume of the thermodynamic system, which is the horizon of the black hole, then
But anyways, in your particular case, seeing as you have connectivity everywhere like that, you could view it as some type of more fractal-type object where the area is actually the same thing as the volume almost. Right? Because you've got, like, when you don't have a lattice, you don't really have the difference between the concept of volume and area.
Yeah, although, I mean, strictly speaking, you could have this in a lattice.
Well, yeah, the lattice, as you said, would only have a few links, but now you have links everywhere.
So when I say a lattice, I meant that the particles are arranged in a lattice, but if you just let the particles interact through local interactions, then they don't have to move.
They can't stay fixed in the lattice.
So you can have the local interactions build up to form global interactions, which is sort of what's happening here. So at least.
Those aren't local interactions.
Okay.
I think two.
Okay.
I think that is the difference between
the domain and
area.
Yeah. Because if you have,
because nearest, you can have nearest neighbor gates and build up arbitrary unitaries from that. So that means definitely you need to the time limit.
Could you do it polynomially?
That's I'm not sure.
I mean, maybe it takes a lot more to build up this much space by local track.
If you wanted to have area scale, then you should only like take, you know, like one goes to the nearest three or four neighbors or something. You know?
Yes,
you can't have these small things going anywhere.
So I did some numerical simulations on like, what happens if you restrict yourself to nearest neighbors?
Well, maybe to a few nearest.
So, for example, this one can only interact with this one, but it cannot interact with that one.
Or the one on top.
You
can allow for like three or four, you know, as long as you don't show out to go anywhere.
So what happens if you do that is that short times you're very, very saving, but long times you're volume saving.
Really? That's more surprising.
What is a short time?
I think that the reason why I wasn't extremely surprised that happens after long time is because you can build up arbitrary unitaries even if you're restricted to the nearest neighbor.
But Oscar, do you mean, so you can have a tenant between each nearest neighbors, but then you can have it like a number of times, you can have the entanglement in some sense propagates through the system, which explains that at short times you only have effectively entanglement with nearest neighbors, but at long times?
Yeah, that's what happens.
And at long times it propagates through the system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what happens.
We're going way over time.
Oh yeah, well, yeah,
I guess we should do it.
So, let's thank Oscar. So we're coming back at